Look here, through the opening where this freshet runs. Upstream, I can see only more jungle. Downstream, there is the gleam of water as though it empties into a lake. I warned you that the rooms open out, and that you might find that disturbing. It is also said that the walls of these places are specula, whose reflective power creates the appearance of vast space. I once knew a woman who had met Father Ynir. She told me a tale about him. Would you like to hear it? Suit yourself. Actually, it was I who wanted to hear the story, and I did suit myself. I told it to myself in the recesses of my mind, hearing it there hardly less than I had heard it first when Thekla's hands, white and cold as lilies taken from a grave filled with rain, lay clasped between my own. I was 13 Severian, and I had a friend named Dominina. She was a pretty girl who looked several years younger than she really was. Perhaps that's why he took a fancy to her. I know you know nothing of the House Absolute. You must take my word for it, that at one place in the Hall of Meaning there are two mirrors. Each is 3 or 4 ells wide, and each extends to the ceiling. There's nothing between the two except a few dozen strides of marble floor. In other words, anyone who walks down the Hall of Meaning sees himself infinitely multiplied there. Each mirror reflects the images in its twin. Naturally, it's an attractive spot when you're a girl and fancy yourself something of a beauty. Dominina and I were playing there one night, turning around and around to show off new chemisias. We had moved a couple of big candelabra, so one was on the left of one mirror and the other on the left of the facing one, at opposite corners, if you see what I mean. We were so busy looking at ourselves that we didn't notice Father Ynir until he was only a step away. Ordinarily, you understand, we would have run and hidden when we saw him coming, though he was scarcely taller than we. He wore iridescent robes that seemed to fade into gray when I looked at them, as if they had been dyed in mist. "You must be wary, children, of looking at yourselves like that," he said. "There's an imp who waits in silvered glass and creeps into the eyes of those who look into it." I knew what he meant and blushed, but Dominina said, "I think I've seen him. Is he shaped like a tear, all gleaming?" Father Ynir did not hesitate before he answered her, or even blink. Still, I understood that he was startled. He said, "No, that is someone else, Dulcinea. Can you see him plainly? No? Then come into my presence chamber tomorrow a little after noons, and I'll show him to you." We were frightened when he left. Dominina swore 100 times that she would not go. I applauded her resolution and tried to strengthen her in it. More to the point, we arranged that she should stay with me that night and the next day. It was all for nothing. A little before the appointed time, a servant in a livery neither of us had ever seen came for poor Dominina. A few days before, I had been given a set of paper figures. There were soubrettes, columbines, coryphees, harlequinas, figurants, and so on, the usual thing. I remember that I waited on the window seat all afternoon for Dominina, toying with these little people, coloring their costumes with wax pencils, arranging them in various ways, and inventing games she and I would play when she came back. At last my nurse called me to supper. By that time I thought Father Ynir had killed Dominina, or that he had sent her back to her mother with an order that she must never visit us again. Just as I was finishing my soup, there was a knock. I heard Mother's servitrix go to answer the door. Then Dominina burst in. I'll never forget her face. It was as white as the faces of the dolls. She cried, and my nurse comforted her. And eventually we got the story out of her. The man who had been sent for her had taken her through halls she hadn't known existed. That, you understand, Severian, was frightening in itself. We both thought ourselves perfectly familiar with our wing of the House Absolute. Eventually, he had led her into what must have been the presence chamber. She said it was a large room, with hangings of a solid dark red, and almost no furniture, except for vases, taller than a man and wider than she could spread her arms. In the center was what she at first took to be a room within the room. The walls were octagonal and painted with labyrinths. Over it, just visible from where she stood at the entrance to the presence chamber, burned the brightest lamp she had ever seen. It was blue-white, she said, and so brilliant an eagle could not have kept his eyes on it. She had heard the click of the bolt when the door had been closed behind her. There was no other exit she could see. She ran to the curtains, hoping to find another door behind them, but as soon as she pulled one aside, one of the eight walls, painted with labyrinths, opened, and Father Anir stepped out. Behind him she saw what she called a bottomless hole filled with light. "There you are," he said. "You've come just in time. Child, the fish is nearly caught. You can watch the setting of the hook and learn by what means his golden scales are to be meshed in our landing net." He took her arm and led her into the octagonal enclosure. At this point, I was forced to interrupt my tale to help Agia through a section of the path almost completely overgrown. "You're talking to yourself," she said. "I can hear you muttering behind me." "I'm telling myself the story I mentioned to you. You seem to have no wish to hear it, and I wanted to listen to it again. Besides, it concerns the specula of Father Anir, and may contain hints useful to us." Dominina drew away. In the center of the enclosure, just under the lamp, was a haze of yellow light. It was never still, she said. It moved up and down and from side to side with rapid flickerings, never leaving a space that might have been four spans high and four long. It did indeed remind her of a fish, much more than the faint flagey she had glimpsed in the mirrors of the Hall of Meaning ever had, a fish swimming in air, confined to an invisible bowl. Father Anir drew the wall of the octagon closed behind them. It was a mirror in which she could see his face and hand and shining, indefinite robes reflected. Her own form, too, and the fish's, but there seemed to be another girl, her own face peering over her shoulder. Then another and another and another, each with a smaller face behind it, and so on, ad infinitum. An endless chain of fainter Dominina faces. She realized when she saw them that the wall of the octagonal enclosure through which she had passed faced another mirror. In fact, all the others were mirrors. The light of the blue-white lamp was caused by them all and reflected from one to another as boys might pass silver balls interlacing and intertwining in an interminable dance. In the center, the fish flickered to and fro, a thing formed, as it seemed, by the convergence of the light. "Here you see him," Father Anir said. "The ancients who knew this process at least as well as we, and perhaps better, considered the fish the least important and most common of the inhabitants of Specula. With their false belief that the creatures they summoned were ever present in the depths of the glass, we need not concern ourselves. In time, they turned to a more serious question. By what means may travel be affected when the point of departure is at an astronomical distance from the place of arrival? Can I put my hand through him? At this stage you may, child. Later I would not advise it. She did so and felt a sliding warmth. Is this how the Kakajins come? Has your mother ever taken you riding in her flyer?
Of course.
And you have seen the toy flyers older children make on the Pleasance at night, with paper hulls and parchment lanterns. What you see here is to the means used to travel between suns, as those toy flyers are to real ones. Yet we can call up the fish with these, and perhaps other things too. And just as the boys' flyers sometimes set the roof of a pavilion ablaze, so our mirrors, though their concentration is not powerful, are not without danger.
I thought that to travel to the stars, you'd have to sit on the mirror. Father Anir smiled. It was the first time she had seen him smile, and though she knew he meant only that she had amused and pleased him, perhaps more than a grown woman could have, it was not pleasant. No, let me outline the problem to you. When something moves very, very fast as you see all the familiar things in your nursery, when your governess lights your candle, it grows heavy. Not larger, you understand, but only heavier. It is attracted to Earth or any other world more strongly. If it were to move swiftly enough, it would become a world itself, pulling other things to it. Nothing ever does, but if something did, that is what would happen. Yet even the light from your candle does not move swiftly enough to travel between the suns. The fish flickered up and down, forward and back. Couldn't you make a bigger candle? I feel sure Dominina was thinking of the Paschal candle she saw each spring, thicker than a man's thigh. Such a candle could be made, but its light would fly no more swiftly. Yet even though light is so weightless, we have given its name to that condition. It presses against what it falls on, just as wind, which we cannot see, pushes the arms of a mill. See now what happens when we provide light to mirrors set face to face. The image they reflect travels from one to the other and returns. Suppose it meets itself in returning. What do you suppose happens then? Dominina laughed despite her fear and said she could not guess. Why, it cancels itself. Think of two little girls running across a lawn without looking where they're going. When they meet, there are no more little girls running. But if the mirrors are well made and the distances between them are correct, the images do not meet. Instead, one comes behind the other. That has no effect when the light comes from a candle or a common star, because both the earlier light and the later light that would otherwise tend to drive it forward are only random white light, like the random waves a little girl might make by flinging a handful of pebbles into a lily pond. But if the light is from a coherent source and forms the image reflected from an optically exact mirror, the orientation of the wave fronts is the same because the image is the same. Since nothing can exceed the speed of light in our universe, the accelerated light leaves it and enters another. When it slows again, it re-enters ours, naturally at another place.
Is it just a reflection?
Dominina asked. She was looking at the fish.
Eventually, it will be a real being. If we do not darken the lamp or shift the mirrors. For a reflected image to exist without an object to originate it violates the laws of our universe, and therefore an object will be brought into existence.
Look, Adya said. We're coming to something. The shade of the tropical trees were so intense that spots of sunshine on the path seemed to blaze like molten gold. I squinted to peer beyond their burning shafts of light.
A house, set on stilts of yellow wood. It's thatched with palm fronds. Can't you see it?
Something moved, and the hut seemed to spring at my eyes as it emerged from the pattern of greens, yellows, and blacks. A shadowed splotch became a doorway, two sloping lines, the angle of the roof. A man in light-colored clothes stood on a tiny veranda, looking down the path at us. I straightened my mantle.
You don't have to do that, Adya said. It doesn't matter in here. If you're hot, take it off.
I removed the mantle and folded it over my left arm. The man on the veranda turned with an expression of unmistakable terror and went into the hut. Chapter 21. The Hut in the Jungle. A ladder led to the veranda. It was made of the same knobby-jointed wood as the hut, lashed together with vegetable fiber.
You're not going up that, Adya protested.
If we're going to see what's to be seen here, we must, I said, and recalling the state of your undergarments, I thought you might feel more comfortable if I preceded you. She surprised me by blushing.
It will only lead to such a house as was used in the hot parts of the world in ancient days. You'll soon be bored, believe me.
Then we can come down and we will have lost very little time. I swung myself up the ladder. It sagged and creaked alarmingly, but I knew that in a public pleasure ground, it was impossible that it should be really dangerous. When I was halfway up, I felt Adya behind me. The interior was hardly larger than one of our cells, but there all resemblance ceased. In our oubliette, the overwhelming impression was of solidity and mass. The metal plates of the walls echoed even the slightest sounds. The floors rang beneath the tread of the journeymen and gave not a hair's breadth under the walker's weight. The ceiling could never fall, but if it should, it would crush everything below it. If it is true that each of us has an antipolaric brother somewhere, a bright twin if we are dark, a dark twin if we are bright, then that hut was surely such a changeling to one of ourselves. There were windows on all sides, save the one through which we entered by the open door, and they had neither bars nor panes nor any other sort of closing. Floor and walls and window frames were of the branches of the yellow tree, branches not planed to boards but left in the round, so that I could, in places, see sunlight through the walls, and if I had dropped a worn orichalc, it would very likely have come to rest on the ground below. There was no ceiling, only a triangular space beneath the roof where pans and food bags hung. A woman was reading aloud in a corner, with a naked man crouched at her feet. The man we had seen from the path stood at the window opposite the door, looking out. I felt that he knew we had come, and even if he had not seen us a few moments before, he must certainly have felt the hut shake when we climbed the ladder, but that he wished to pretend he did not. There is something in the line at the back when a man turns so as not to see, and it was evident in his. The woman read. Then he went up from the plain to Mount Nebo, the headland that faces the city. And the compassionating showed him the whole country, all the land as far as the western sea. Then he said to him, "This is the land I swore to your fathers I should give their sons. You have seen it, but you shall not set your feet upon it." So there he died, and was buried in the ravine.
The naked man at her feet nodded.
"It is even so with our own masters, preceptress. With the smallest finger it is given, but the thumb is hooked into it, and a man has only to take the gift and dig in the floor of his house and cover all with a mat. Then the thumb begins to pull, and bit by bit the gift rises from the earth and ascends into the sky and is seen no more."
The woman seemed impatient with this and began,
"No, Isengoma."
But the man at the window interrupted her without turning around.
"Be quiet, Marie. I want to hear what he has to say. You can explain later." "A nephew of mine," the naked man continued, "a member of my own fire circle, had no fish. And so he took up his gaudali and went to a certain pool. So quietly did he lean over the water, he might have been a tree."
The naked man leaped up as he said this, and posed his sinewy frame as though to spear the woman's feet with a shaft of air.
"Long, long he stood, until the monkeys no longer feared him and returned to drop sticks in the water. And the Hesperon fluttered to her nest. A big fish came out of his den in the sunken trunks. My nephew watched him circle slowly, slowly. He swam near the surface, and then, when my nephew was about to drive home the three-toothed spear, there was no longer a fish to be seen, but a lovely woman. At first my nephew thought the fish was the Fish King, who had changed his form that he might not be speared. Then he saw the fish moving beneath the woman's face, and knew that he saw a reflection. He looked up at once, but there was nothing to be seen but the whisk of the vines. The woman was gone."
The naked man looked up, mimicking very well the amazement of the fisherman.
"That night my nephew went to the Newman, the proud one, and slit the throat of a young Oreodont, saying,
'Agia whispered to me, in the name of the Theoanthropos, how long do you mean to stay here? This could go on all day.' 'Let me look about the hut,' I whispered back, 'and we'll go.'
'Mighty is the proud one, sacred all his names. Everything found beneath leaves is his. The storms are carried in his arms. The poison holds no death unless his curse is pronounced over it.'"
The woman said, "I don't think we need all these praises of your fetish, Isengoma. My husband wishes to hear your story." "Very well, but tell it and spare us your litanies."
"The proud one protects his supplicant. Would not he be shamed if one who adores him were to die? Isengoma."
From the window the man said, "He's afraid, Marie. Can't you hear it in his voice?"
"There is no fear for those who wear the sign of the proud one. His breath is the mist that hides the infant Wakaris from the claws of the Margay."
"Robert, if you won't do something about this, I will. Isengoma, be silent. Or leave and never return here again."
"The proud one knows Isengoma loves the preceptress. He would save her if he could."
"Save me from what?"
"Do you think there's one of your dreadful beasts here?"
"If there were, Robert would shoot it with his gun."
"The Tokolosh, preceptress, the Tokolosh come. But the proud one, in his condensation, will protect us. He is the mighty commander of all Tokolosh. When he roars, they hide beneath the fallen leaves.
Robert, I think he's lost his mind.
He has eyes, Marie, and you don't.
What do you mean by that? And why do you keep looking out that window?
Quite slowly, the man turned to face us. For a moment he looked at Adjia and me, then he turned away. His expression was the one I have seen our clients wear when Master Gerlow showed them the instruments to be used in their anacrisis.
Robert, for goodness sake, tell me what's wrong with you.
As Isangoma says, the Tokolosh are here. Not his, I think, but ours. Death and the Lady. Have you heard of them, Marie? The woman shook her head. She had risen from her seat and opened the lid of a small chest. You wouldn't have, I suppose. It's a picture, an artistic theme, rather. Pictures by several artists. Isangoma, I don't think your proud one has much authority over these, Tokolosh. These come from Paris, where I used to be a student, to remonstrate with me for giving up art for this. The woman said,
You have a fever, Robert. That's obvious. I'm going to give you something, and you'll feel better soon.
The man looked toward us again, at Adja's face and my own, as though he did not wish to do so, but found himself unable to control the motion of his eyes. If I am ill, Marie, then the diseased know things the well have overlooked. Isangoma knows they're here too, don't forget. Didn't you feel the floor tremble while you were reading to him? That was when they came in, I think.
I've just poured you a glass of water so you can swallow your quinine. There are no ripples in it.
What are they, Isangoma? Tokolosh. But what are Tokolosh?
Bad spirits, preceptor.
When man think bad thought, or woman do bad thing, there is another Tokolosh. He stay behind. Man think no one know, everyone dead. But Tokolosh remain until end of world. Then everyone will see. Know what that man did.
The woman said, What a horrible idea.
Her husband's hands clenched the yellow stick of the windowsill.
Don't you see? They are only the results of what we do. They are the spirits of the future, and we make them ourselves.
They are a lot of pagan nonsense. That's what I see, Robert.
Listen. Your vision is so sharp. Can't you listen for a moment?
I am listening. What do you want to say?
Nothing. I only want you to listen. What do you hear?
The hut fell silence. I listened too, and could not have not listened, if I had wanted to. Outside, the monkeys chattered and the parrots screamed as before. Then I heard, over the jungle noises, a faint humming, as though an insect as large as a boat were flying far away.
What is it? The man asked. The mail plane. If you're lucky, you should be able to see it soon.
The man craned his neck out the window, and I, curious to see what he was looking for, went to the window on his left and looked out as well. The foliage was so thick that at first it seemed impossible to see anything. But he was staring almost straight up, past the edge of the thatch, and I found a patch of blue there. The humming grew louder. Into view came the strangest flyer I have ever seen. It was winged, as if it had been built by some race that had not yet realized that since it would not flap wings like a bird, in any case, there was no reason its lift, like a kite's, could not come from its hull. There was a bulbous swelling on each argent pinion, and a third at the front of the hull. The light seemed to glimmer before these swellings.
In 3 days, we could be at the landing strip, Robert. The next time it comes, we would be waiting.
If the Lord has sent us here.
Yes, Preceptor. We must do what the Proud One wishes. There is none like he.
Preceptress, let me dance to the Proud One and sing his song. Then it may be the Tokolosh will depart.
The naked man snatched her book from the woman and began to beat it with the flat of his hand, rhythmic claps as though he played a tambour. His feet scraped the uneven floor, and his voice, beginning with a melodic stridulation, became the voice of a child.
In the night when all is silent, hear him screaming in the treetops, see him dancing in the fire. He lives in the arrow poison, tiny as a yellow firefly, brighter than a falling star. Hairy men walk in the forest.
Adjia said, I'm leaving Severian, and stepped through the doorway behind us. If you want to stay and watch this, you can.
But you'll have to get your Avern yourself and find your way to the sanguinary fields. Do you know what will happen if you fail to appear?
They'll employ assassins, you said.
And the assassins will employ the snake called Yellowbeard. Not on you at first. On your family, if you have any, and your friends. Since I've been with you all over our quarter of the city, that probably means me.
He comes when the sun is setting. See his feet upon the water. Tracks of flame across the water.
The chant continued, but the chanter knew we were going. His sing-song held a note of triumph. I waited until Adjia had reached the ground, then followed her. She said, I thought you'd never leave. Now that you're here, do you really like this place so much?
The metallic colors of her torn gown seemed as angry as she herself against the cool green of the unnaturally dark leaves.
No, I said, but I find it interesting. Did you see their flyer?
When you and the inmate looked out the windows?
I wasn't such a fool.
It was like no other I've ever seen. I should have been looking at the roof facets of this building, but instead I saw the flyer he expected to see. At least that's what it seemed like. Something from somewhere else.
A little while ago I wanted to tell you about a friend of mine who was caught in Father Anir's mirrors. She found herself in another world. And even when she returned to Thekla, that was my friend's name, she wasn't quite sure she had found her way back to her real point of origin. I wonder if we aren't still in the world those people left, instead of them in ours.
Adjia had already started down the path. Flecks of sunlight seemed to turn her brown hair to dark gold as she looked over her shoulder to say, I told you certain visitors are attracted to certain bioscapes.
I trotted to catch up with her.
As time goes on, their minds bend to conform to their surroundings, and it may be they bend ours as well.
It was probably an ordinary flyer you saw.
He saw us. So did the savage.
From what I've heard, the further an inhabitant's consciousness must be warped, the more residual perceptions are likely to remain. When I meet monsters, wild men, and so forth in these gardens, I find they're a lot more likely to be at least partially aware of me than the others are.
Explain the man, I said.
I didn't build this place, Severian.
All I know is that if you turn around on the path now, that last place we saw probably won't be there. Listen, I want you to promise me that when we get out of here, you'll let me take you straight to the Garden of Endless Sleep. We don't have time left for anything else, not even the Garden of Delectation. And you're not really the kind of person who ought to go sightseeing in here.
Because I wanted to stay in the sand garden?
Partly, yes. You're going to make trouble for me here sooner or later, I think.
As she said that, we rounded one of the path's seemingly endless sinuosities. A log tagged with a small white rectangle that could only be a species sign lay across the path. And through the crowding leaves on our left, I could see the wall, its greenish glass forming an unobtrusive backdrop for the foliage. Agia had already taken a step past the door when I shifted Terminus Est to the other hand and opened it for her. Chapter 22 Dorcas. When I had first heard of the flower, I had imagined averns would be grown on benches, in rows like those in the conservatory of the Citadel. Later, when Agia had told me more about the Botanic Gardens, I conceived of a place like Necropolis, where I had frolicked as a boy, with trees and crumbling tombs and walkways paved with bones. The reality was very different. A dark lake in an infinite fen. Our feet sank in sedge, and a cold wind whistled past with nothing, as it seemed, to stop it before it reached the sea. Rushes grew beside the track on which we walked, and once or twice a water bird passed overhead, black against a misted sky. I had been telling Agia about Thecla. Now she touched my arm.
You can see them from here, though we'll have to go half around the lake to pluck one. Look where I'm pointing. That smudge of white.
They don't look dangerous from here.
They've done for a great many people, I can assure you. Some of them are interred in this garden, I imagine.
So, there were graves after all. I asked where the mausoleum stood.
There aren't any. No coffins either, or mortuary urns, or any of that clutter. Look at the water slopping at your boots.
I did. It was as brown as tea.
It has the property of preserving corpses. The bodies are weighed down by forcing lead shot down their throats, then sunk here, with their positions mapped, so they can be fished up again later if anyone wants to look at them.
I would readily have sworn that there was no one within a league of where we stood. Or at least, if the segments of the glass building really confined the spaces they enclosed, as they were supposed to do, within the borders of the Garden of Endless Sleep. But Agia had no sooner said what she did than the head and shoulders of an old man appeared over the top of some reeds a dozen paces off.
"'Tis not true," he called. "I know they say so, but 'tisn't right."
Agia, who had allowed the torn bodice of her gown to hang as it would, quickly drew it up again.
"I didn't know I was talking to anyone but my escort here."
The old man ignored the rebuke. No doubt his thoughts were already too involved with the remark he had overheard for him to pay much heed.
"I've the figure here. Would you like to see it? You, young sir, you've an education, anyone can tell that. Will you look?"
He appeared to be carrying a staff. I watched its head rise and fall several times before I understood that he was poling toward us.
"More trouble," Agia said. "We'd better go."
I asked if it might not be possible for the old man to ferry us across the lake, thus saving us the long walk around. He shook his head.
"Too heavy for my little boat. There's but room for Cass and me here. You great folk would capsize us."
The prow came into sight, and I saw that what he said was true. The skiff was so small it seemed almost too much to ask of it
that it keep the old man himself afloat. Though he was bowed and shrunken by age, he appeared older even than Master Palaemon, until he could hardly have weighed more than a boy of 10. There was no one in it with him.
"Your pardon, sir," he said, "but I can't come no nearer. Wet she may be, but she gets too dry for me, or you couldn't walk upon it. Can you step here by the edge, so's I can show you my figure?"
I was curious to see what it was he wanted of us, so I did as he asked, Agia following me reluctantly.
"Here now."
Reaching into his tunic, he pulled out a small scroll.
"Here is the position. Have a look, young sir."
The scroll was headed with some name and a long description of where this person had lived, whose wife she was, and what her husband had done for a living. All of which I only pretended to glance at, I am afraid. Below the description were a crude map and two numbers.
"Now you see, sir, it ought to be easy enough. First number there, that's paces over from the Falstrom. Second number's paces up. Now would you believe that for all these years I've been trying to find her, and never found her yet?"
Looking at Agia, he drew himself up until he stood almost normally.
"I'd believe it," Agia said. "And if it will satisfy you, I'm sorry to hear it, but it has nothing to do with us."
She turned to go, but the old man thrust out his pole to prevent my following her.
"Don't you heed what they say. They put them where the figure shows, but they don't stay there. Some has been seed in the river, even."
He looked vaguely toward the horizon.
"Out there."
I told him I doubted that was possible.
"All the water here. Where'd you think it come from?" "There's a conduit underground that brings it, and if it didn't, this whole place would dry out. When they get to moving about, what's to prevent one from swimming through? What's to prevent 20?
Can't be any current to speak of.
You and her, you come to get Aeverne, did you? You know why they planted them here to begin with?"
I shook my head.
"For the manatees. They're in the river, and used to swim in through the conduit. It scared the kin to see their faces bobbing in the lake. So Father Aenea had the gardeners plant the Aevernes. I was here and saw it. Just a little man he is, with a wry neck and bow legs. If a manatee comes now, those flowers kill it in the night. One morning I come looking for Cass, like I always do, unless I've something else I have to take care of, and there was two curators on the shore with a harpoon. Dead manatee in the lake, they said. I went out with my hook and got it, and it wasn't no manatee, but a man. He'd spit up his lead, or they hadn't put enough in.
Looked as good as you or her, and better than me."
"Had he been dead long?"
"No way of telling, for the water here pickles them. You'll hear it said it turned their skin to leather, and so it does. But don't think of the sole of your boot when you hear it. More like a woman's glove."
Agia was far ahead of us, and I began to walk after her. The old man followed us, poling his skiff parallel to the floating path of sedge.
"I told them I'd had better luck in one day for them than I've had in 40 years for myself. Here's what I use."
He held up an iron grapple on a length of rope.
"Not that I haven't caught a plenty. All kinds. But not Cass. I started where the figure showed, year after she died. She wasn't there, so I kept working my way out. After 5 years of that, I was a ways far away, That's what I thought then, from what it said. I got to be afraid she might be there after all, so I begun over. First where it said, then working out. 10 years of that. I got to be afraid again. So what I do now is start in the morning where it says, and make my first cast there. After that I go to where I stopped the last time, and circle out some more. She's not where it says, I know that. I know everyone that's there now, and some of them I've pulled up 100 times. But she's wandering. And I keep thinking, maybe she'll come home.
She was your wife. The old man nodded, and to my surprise said nothing. Why do you want to recover her body? Still he said nothing. His pole made no sound as it slipped in and out of the water. The skiff left only the faintest of wakes behind it, tiny ripples that lapped the side of the sedge track like the tongues of kittens. Are you sure you would know her after so long a time if you found her?
Yes. Yes.
He nodded slowly at first, then vigorously.
You're thinking I may have hooked her already. Drug her up, looked her in the face, and throwed her back in, ain't you? It ain't possible. Not now, Cass. You wondered why I want her back. One reason is the memory I have of her. The one that's strongest is of this brown water closing over her face. Her eyes shut. Do you know about that?
I'm not certain I know what you mean.
They've a cement they put on the lids. It's supposed to hold them down forever. But when the water hit them, they opened. Explain that. It's what I remember. What comes into my mind when I try to sleep. This brown water rolling over her face and her eyes opening blue through the brown. I have to go to sleep 5-6 times every night, what with the waking up. Before I lie down here myself, I'd like to have another picture there. Her face coming back up. Even if it's only on the end of my hook. You follow what I say?
I thought of Thecla, and the trickle of blood from beneath the door of her cell, and I nodded.
Then there's the other thing. Cass and I, we had a little shop. Cloisonné work, mostly. Her father and brother had the trade of making it, and they set us up on Signal Street just past the middle, next to the auction house. The building's still there, though. Nobody lives in it. I'd go over to the in-laws and carry the boxes home on my back and pull them open and put the pieces on our shelves. Cass priced them, sold, and kept everything so clean. You know how long we did that? Run our little place?
I shook my head.
4 years, less a month and a week.
Then she died.
Cass died. It wasn't long before it was all gone, but it was the biggest part of my life. I've got a place to sleep in a loft now. A man I knew years before, though that was years after Cass was gone, he lets me sleep there. There isn't a piece of cloisonné in it, or a garment, or so much as a nail from the old shop. I tried to keep a locket and Cass's combs, but everything's gone. Tell me this now. How am I to know it wasn't no dream?
It seemed to me that the old man might be spellcaught, as the people in the House of Yellow Wood had been. So I said, I have no way of knowing. Perhaps, as you say, it was a dream. I think you torment yourself too much. His mood changed in an instant, as I have seen the moods of young children do, and he laughed.
It's easy to see, sir, that despite the outfit under that mantle, you're no torturer. I do truly wish I could ferry you and your doxy. Since I can't, there's a fellow farther along that has a bigger boat. He comes here pretty often, and he talks to me sometimes like you did. Tell him I hope he'll take you across.
I thanked him and hurried after Agia, who by this time was a great distance ahead. She was limping, and I recalled how far she had walked today after wrenching her leg. As I was about to overtake her and give her my arm, I made one of those missteps that seemed disastrous and enormously humiliating at the time, though one laughs at them afterward, and in so doing, I set in motion one of the strangest incidents of my admittedly strange career. I began to run, and in running came too near the inner side of a curve in the track. At one moment I was bounding along on the springy sedge. At the next, I was floundering in icy brown water, much impeded by my mantle. For the space of a breath I knew again the terror of drowning. Then I righted myself and got my face above water. The habits developed on all those summer swims in Guile reasserted themselves. I blew the water from my nose and mouth, took a deep breath, and pushed my sopping hood back from my face. I was no sooner calm than I realized that I had dropped Terminus Est, and at that moment losing that blade seemed more terrible than the chance of death. I dove, not even troubling to kick off my boots, forcing my way through an umber fluid that was not water purely, but water laced and thickened with the fibrous stems of the reeds. These stems, though they multiplied the threat of drowning many times, saved Terminus Est for me. She would surely have outraced me to the bottom and buried herself in the mud there, despite the meager air retained in her sheath, if her fall had not been obstructed. As it was, 8 or 10 cubits beneath the surface, one frantically groping hand encountered the blessed, familiar shape of her onyx grip. At the same instant, my other hand touched an object of a completely different kind. It was another human hand, and its grasp, for it had seized my own the moment I touched it, coincided so perfectly with the recovery of Terminus Est, that it seemed the hand's owner was returning my property to me, like the tall mistress of the Pelerines. I felt a surge of lunatic gratitude. Then fear returned tenfold. The hand was pulling my own, drawing me down. Chapter 23 Hildegrin. With what must surely have been the last strength I possessed, I managed to throw Terminus Est onto the floating track of sedge and grasp its ragged margin before I sank again. Someone caught me by the wrist. I looked up, expecting Agia. It was not she, but a woman younger still, with streaming yellow hair. I strove to thank her, but water, not words, poured from my mouth. She tugged, and I struggled, and at last I lay wholly supported on the sedge, so weak I could do nothing more. I must have rested there at least as long as it takes to say the Angelus, and perhaps longer. I was conscious of the cold, which grew worse, and of the sagging of the whole fabric of rotting plants, which bent beneath my weight, until I was half submerged again. I breathed in great gasps that failed to satisfy my lungs and coughed water. Water trickled from my nostrils, too. Someone, it was a man's voice, a loud one I seemed to have heard a long time before, said, "Pull him over or he'll sink." I was lifted by my belt. In a few moments more I was able to stand, though my legs trembled so I feared I would fall. Agia was there, and the blonde girl who had helped me onto the sedge, and a big beef-faced man. Agia asked what had happened, and half-conscious though I was, I noticed how pale she was.
"Give him time," the big man said. "He'll be all right soon enough."
And then,
"Who in Phlegethon are you?"
He was looking at the girl who seemed as dazed as I felt. She made a stammering sound.
D-d-d-d-d.
Then hung her head and was silent. From hair to heel, she was smeared with mud, and what clothing she had seemed no better than rags. The big man asked Agia,
"Where did that one come from?"
"I don't know. When I looked back to see what was keeping Severian, she was pulling him up onto this floating path."
"Good thing she did, too. Good for him, anyway. Is she mad, or..."
"Shan't caught here, you think?" I said, "Whatever she is, she saved me."
"Can't you give her something to cover herself with? She must be freezing."
I was freezing myself, now that I was alive enough to notice it. The big man shook his head and seemed to draw his heavy coat about him more closely.
"Not unless she gets clean, I won't. And she won't unless she's put back in the water and stirred around, too. But I've something here that's the next best thing. And maybe better."
From one of his coat pockets he took a metal flask shaped like a dog, which he handed to me. A bone in the dog's mouth proved to be the stopper. I offered the flask to the blonde girl, who at first seemed not to know what to do with it. Agia took it from her and held it to her lips until she had taken several swallows, then handed it back to me. The content seemed to be plum brandy. Its fiery impact washed away the bitterness of the fen water very pleasantly. By the time I replaced the bone in the dog's mouth, his belly was, I think, better than half empty.
"Now then," said the big man, "I think you people ought to tell me who you are and what you're doing here. And don't none of you say you've just come to see the sights of the garden. I see enough gawkers these days to know them before they come in hailing distance."
He looked at me.
"That's a good big whittle you've got there to begin with."
Agia said, "The armiger is in costume. He has been challenged, and has come to cut an avern."
"He's in costume and you aren't, I suppose. Do you think I don't know stage brocade? And bare feet, too, when I see them?"
"I never said I was not in costume, nor that I was of his rank. As for my shoes, I left them outside so as not to ruin them in this water."
The big man nodded in a way that gave no clue as to whether he believed her or not.
"Now you, Goldie Hair, the embroidered baggage here has already said she don't know you. And from the look of him, I don't believe her fish, that you pulled out for her and a good piece of work that was too, knows any more than I do. Maybe not that much. So who are you?"
The blonde girl swallowed.
"Dorcas."
"And how'd you get here, Dorcas? And how'd you get in the water? For that's where you've been, plainly. You couldn't have got that wet just pulling out our young friend."
The brandy had brought a flush to the girl's cheeks, but her face was as vacant and bewildered as before, or nearly so.
"I don't know," she whispered.
Agia asked, "You don't remember coming here?" Dorcas shook her head. "Then what's the last thing you do remember?" There was a long silence. The wind seemed to be blowing harder than ever, and despite the drink, I was miserably cold. At last Dorcas murmured,
"Sitting by a window. There were pretty things in the window. Trays and boxes and a rood."
The big man said,
"Pretty things? Well, if you was there, I'm assured there was.
She's mad, Agia said. Either someone's been taking care of her and she's